Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Musk-Hawain. Roughly one in five Americans lives with a disability, which technically makes people with disabilities the largest minority group in America. 29 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act became law, the struggle to see it fully implemented continues. In 2016, the New York Times launched its Disability Series, a column that created space for people living with disabilities to share intimate stories of navigating life in a world not built for them. They are powerful stories about the human experience, of love, of work, of coping, of belonging, and of all that it means to move through life with an added physical, cognitive, sensory, or other challenge. Most importantly, they are stories that are changing the conversation about disability in America. And now they've been collected in a new book called About Us, Essays from the Disability Series of the New York Times. Three of the contributors to that book are local writers, and they're with us today to share their stories. Ona Gritz is a writer whose work has appeared in numerous publications. Her memoir, On the Whole, A Story of Mothering and Disability, has been described as required reading for all new moms. Daniel Simpson is a poet, musician, computer programmer, and former high school English teacher. His work has been published in a number of literary reviews, as well as in the book Beauty is a Verb, The New Poetry of Disability. And Daniel also happens to be the husband of Ona Gritz. And then, of course, we have with us Anne Kyer, forgive me, Anne, I just lost my paper here, and she teaches creative writing and literature at Arcadia University and Rosemont College. She also holds a PhD from Harvard University, and she is the author of the memoir Home with Henry. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start here. We have lots to talk about today. And by the way, let me invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Anne Kyer, let me start with you. What are you hoping that this new book, this collection of essays, will accomplish?
Well, I think that, like every writer, number one, I hope that people will buy it and read it. but I think also the great thing about this series is that it shows how, frankly, rather ordinary so many people who have a disability are, and what our ordinary lives are like. They're not so very different from anybody else's in many essentials. And I think that that was part of the aim of Peter Catapano, who was the editor at the Times. The other good thing about this, and I can say this because I'm only one of 60 writers in this book, is that all of these essays are written by experienced writers. So, you know, you get things that are pretty well crafted and have been worked over. It's not just an effusion for the moment. And I hope that level of craftsmanship does two things. Number one, draws in the reader, which is what we want to have happen, so that the readers get the feeling of experiencing life as we're describing it. And number two, not to put too fine a point on it, shows how bloody smart we all are.
Amen to that. Well, you know, you mentioned sort of this, the image sometimes that people have
right.
of those who are living with
yeah.
disabilities. And
right.
I was reading a piece by Melissa Blake, who is a blogger who has disabilities, and she talked about, you know, this antiquated idea, I'm quoting from her piece, that disabled people live out their days at home, closed off from the rest of the world, maybe a blanket draped over their lap.
Right?
Right. And that is not what yeah. we're talking about here,
no,
for sure.
Of course not.
Ona, what's the response to the book been so far?
So far, it's been very positive. It's been getting good reviews, and we're pretty excited about it.
Yeah. Daniel, what about for you? What are you hoping that people will take away from this book?
Well, I just actually found out that I could get it in an Audible form from audible.com or on CD. So I just started reading recently, and I hope that it will show actually not only what's similar in all of us, but how we differ. I read a fascinating article by Bradley Snyder about how to really see a blind person. I agreed with much, you know, but we're different in other ways. So I think to see that, like any segment of society, we agree and we disagree. And I guess I feel like I know when, even for me, thinking about people with disabilities other than mine, which is blindness, there are things that I feel awkward about. And it's great to see and to hear a little bit of what life is like for other people.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, on the subject of blindness, I'm wondering if you could share with us some of the challenges that you experience just in dealing with others. You just mentioned the whole idea of, you know, how to interact with a blind person. And what are some of the challenges or the observations that you have made in dealing with other people?
Well, let's see. at some point we'll talk about what's easy and great with other people. But what's challenging is people often mix up blindness and deafness, and so they will shout to me, or it's either that, or they will say to Ona or whoever I'm with, does he want ketchup on his fries? Do you want ketchup? Does he want ketchup with that? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, yes, he does.
Wow.
And I guess maybe from people handling steering wheels, I also find that people's immediate reaction when they think I'm going to step into a crater or something is to grab me from behind and steer me like a vehicle. And I tell people it's much better if I hold on to your arm, because if we hit a cliff, you'll probably stop. But if you don't, I'll have some warning.
And that's got to be startling, too, when people who are well-meaning probably, but just sort of randomly grab you in an effort to protect you or redirect you, there's probably something startling about that.
There is, but you mentioned a good word, which is well-meaning. And I do try to remember that people, I think most people want the best and are trying to do the best, but we have a little bit of education to do yet. How to do that.
Yeah. Ona, let's talk about your challenge. Explain to us what it is and how you navigate it.
I have cerebral palsy, which is it usually happens at birth. It's a form of brain damage, and it affects the part of the brain that controls motor function. And I'm very fortunate. I have a pretty mild case. It basically divides my body in half. So only my right side is affected, and I have limited dexterity on that side, and it affects my gait is uneven because of it.
I have been reading some of your work, and I would love for you to read a little passage for us from one of your pieces. It's called Love Eventually,
yes.
I believe. And in your introduction, I mentioned that your memoir has been described as required reading for all new moms. But I think because it speaks to the challenges of motherhood, which are many for disabled and non-disabled
yes.
people. And I think that particular passage was so relatable. So I'd love it if you would read that for
sure,
us.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Reality finally hit when we had a child. My husband eventually developed a very loving relationship with our son, but he wasn't exactly hands-on in the beginning. Before Ethan's birth, I hadn't understood that parenting is physically demanding work. Caring for a newborn, especially, requires strength, balance, and an ambidexterity I simply don't have. I couldn't bathe Ethan safely, carry him on stairs, or even sip from a water glass while he nursed if his head rested on my good arm. Finally, I was forced to acknowledge that my CP is more than a cosmetic issue. Some tasks I could manage by making adaptions, but for many, I needed to ask for help. At first, I felt deeply embarrassed by what I perceived as my ineptitude. But at some point, while I was busy figuring out ways to get the work done, I forgot about the shame. By the time Ethan turned 3, the physical demands of mothering had lessened, and I could focus on the parts that came easily, talking with him, reading together, entering into his imaginary worlds. A year later, my husband and I divorced. Thankfully, by then, I understood that my tie to him wasn't what made me whole. In a long-ago interview with Bill Moyers, Maya Angelou revealed her theory that most women marry other people's husbands. She didn't elaborate, but I immediately understood. Out of hopefulness, impatience, insecurity, or for a thousand other reasons, we too often rush into relationships that are poor fits for us, robbing our partners and ourselves of more promising connections. It struck me as likely that those of us with disabilities are especially susceptible to this. I have finally married my own husband, Ms. Angelou went on to say. Many years after my first marriage, so did I.
And he happens to be sitting right next to you.
He does.
One Daniel Simpson.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Ona, for sharing that with us. And we'll circle back to that. But before we go to our break, Ann Kyer, I want to talk with you as well about the challenge that you are living with. Explain to us.
I have one never knows whether to say skin disorder or skin condition, but it's called ichthyosis, and it's a genetic disorder. So in my case, a moderate to severe case. And I think at this point about 300 babies a year in the U.S. are born with what I have, lamellar ichthyosis. So it's very rare, and ich is the Greek word for fish. It took me a while to kind of get my head around that, but the association is that fish have scales, and people with ichthyosis also have a certain amount of scaling, dry skin, perpetually shedding, and in my instance, a sort of red face, more of an inflammation. There are other kinds of ichthyosis, but for today, we'll concentrate on mine. And it's a recessive genetic mutation. And you're talking to an English major here, so I can't give you the chemistry of it. But many people, like my parents, met and married and had children and had no idea that each of them carried a recessive gene for this problem. And so there's a 1 in 4 chance of getting it. I have a twin brother who is not affected. And so that's my route to being part of the physically different or disabled community.
Yeah, and one that any of us can enter at any time. We have much more to talk about as it relates to this new book, About Us, Essays from the Disability Series of the New York Times. We'll welcome your questions and comments as well when Radio Times comes right back. Stay with us. And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about Americans living with disabilities. 1 in 5 Americans, at least 1 in 5, is living with some sort of disability. And technically, that would make people living with disabilities the largest minority group in America. There is a new book that is a collection of essays that has been written by gifted writers. There are 60 essays in total in this book. It is called About Us, Essays from the Disability Series of the New York Times. And so this is a carefully curated selection of essays on themes like coping, loving, work, justice, belonging, the kinds of things that all of us grapple with from day to day. And we are fortunate to have 3 local writers with us in studio who have all contributed to this brand new book. We'd love for you to add your voice to the conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Our guests are Ann Kyer. She is one of the contributors to About Us, and her memoir is called Home with Henry. Ona Gritz, also, of course, a contributor She's the author of On the Whole, A Story of Mothering and Disability. And her husband, Daniel Simpson, is with us as well, another contributor. And his poetry collections include School for the Blind and Border Songs, which she wrote along with Ona. So, Ann Kyer, when we left off, we were talking about the skin condition that mm-hmm. you have been living with. And, of mm-hmm. course, you write about that
yes.
in
mm-hmm.
this collection of essays. I'd right. love to hear in your voice a passage from one of your essays.
Sure. This is called Finding Refuge with the Skin I'm In. The checkout lady's panic surged as she held the coins 6 inches above my hand and dropped them into my palm. They clanged until I made a fist. She ran her fingernails through her hair. "What's wrong with you?" she asked, her voice rising to a higher pitch. I slid the money into a jeans pocket and stroked my thigh to calm down. "It's just dry skin," I murmured. That wasn't true. I have lamellar ichthyosis, a genetic disorder which manifests itself in scales, not only just on my face and arms and hands, which she could see, but over my whole body. My skin is perpetually red and itchy. I can't sweat well, so I'm careful not to get overheated, and I can't walk far in strong sun. I naturally seek the shade. My skin isn't painful, but much of the time, the entire surface of my body feels tight. My eyelids are pulled down by this tightness, too, so I often shield my face with a hat. Standing in the checkout line, I jammed the lovely straw boater I'd gotten in England down to blunt my face. Damn it, I thought, get me out of here. I knew I could smile and tell her my condition was not contagious, but instead I hurried home through narrow city streets, slammed my heavy front door, and headed straight into the tiny walled garden in the back. The garden is my refuge. It's the reason I bought this house. Even a small leafy space is unusual among Philadelphia row homes, and I craved a private place with fresh air and shaded light. I water my 3 trees and hot spells and nurture cool white moonflowers. The unseeing trees and plants comfort me. Pacing the bricks that day, I fought the instinct to go into the house and hide. I can't spend my entire life in bed, I told myself, brushing Japanese maple leaves against my cheek to soothe my skin and my spirit. Hiding was a cop-out, not the mature thing to do.
Thank you so much for
You're
sharing
welcome,
that.
Sure.
And this is something, that, I mean, it's an isolated incident, but it's not, because
right.
I imagine that this is something that you have experienced
Absolutely.
For decades.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. It happens all the time.
And the whole idea of sort of finding refuge.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, two things. Finding refuge is an instinct to hide. And you can't do it all the time, and I have never done it all the time. From the time I was, you know, went to school, and I was sort of mainstreamed when I was 5 years old. But nevertheless, there are moments when it's hard to deal with the kind of fear that an obvious skin condition can evoke in people. People are afraid. People are afraid that I'm contagious, and it's hard to be on the other side of that. The mature thing to do is to say, oh, well, not to worry. You know, you're not going to catch this problem from me, and educate people. So I try to do that, but then I get impatient with it.
Well, and that's an added burden that you have to carry, right?
That's
Feeling compelled
true.
To
yeah.
have to explain.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
So I have this wonderful garden in the back of my house, and every so often I go there, and it's a wonderfully sensuous place and something that I've created. And so it kind of tops up my courage now and then, and also it's something that I just enjoy.
Well, it sounds like an introvert's paradise, whether you are
well,
an introvert or
I
not.
Am
it's
an
sounding
introvert.
Wonderful to me. So. It sounds like a paradise in that respect. Daniel Simpson, let's come back to you. And by the way, I don't know if our listeners could hear it, but we have a fourth guest with us in the studio today. It's Daniel's seeing eye dog, and we've been hearing him under the table there. So just want to let you know that...
That was not me doing that.
That was not Daniel. That was our fourth guest in the studio. So, Daniel, let's circle back to you because you also have some of your work with you, and we'd love to hear a little bit of that.
Okay, great. I have a passage that's also from one of the essays in the book. It's called A Girlfriend of My Own, and I'm writing about ninth grade when my identical twin brother, Dave, who was also blind, he and I transferred from a school for the blind, the Overbrook School for the Blind, right here in Philadelphia, to Great Valley Senior High School. we tried to fit in wherever we could. We went out for wrestling, played four-hand piano, and sang in talent shows. We even threw a birthday party for ourselves, inviting some of the most popular and likable people in our class. There were awkward moments, but we did okay. I had learned to walk with a white cane at Overbrook, but now that I had made the transition to public school, I refused to use it. Wasn't the rule to stay to the right anyway? I shouldn't collide with anyone if we all followed the rules. All the classrooms had their desks lined up in four rows of seven or eight. My desk in World Cultures was the second one down, second row from the door and the side chalkboard. I could navigate this way. I still remember the location of my bed in the open dorm at the School for the Blind when I was four, second one down in the row nearest the lockers. Linda Fulton sat in the fourth seat from the front in the next row to the left. She spoke quietly in a voice as smooth as the surfaces of our desks. In class and in her presence, I tried to feel confident. I spoke up. I projected cool, even though I bet everyone could see through me.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a very relatable experience for a lot of young men at that age.
Yes. You know, that's one of the things, too, about disability. You know, we sometimes can feel like, well, why would other people be interested in our little niche? Except hopefully we're all interested in each other. But it does relate. And in some ways, you pile all the stuff that gets built up around disability on top of just being an adolescent kid. And then I think about women who are with disabilities who have even another layer of stuff built to deal with. So,
well, and I think that's part of the beauty of this book, right, is that it creates a space for these stories so that people who are not disabled can see commonalities that maybe they did not know were there. Would you agree?
I would, yes. And I think in some ways all it takes for me to remember that is to think about situations where, I really don't know what it's like to be a woman. I really don't know what it's like to be Black or Asian American, you know. So I can understand it also by flipping it around where I'm the person who doesn't know.
Yeah. I want to talk about the gift that is wrapped in the challenge for each of you. Ona, what would you say is the gift for you?
I'd say from the beginning, the gift was empathy. That even as a child, I had a sense that people were struggling, you know, and we didn't always know what each other were going through. And I think the gift now is community. All three of us, well, no, with the exception of Dan, whose twin brother was blind, we were the only disabled people in our families. Mm-hmm. So it's a different minority experience in the sense that it's not something that the people around us were going through. And I didn't have a friend who looked like me until I was 25.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was an amazing experience to finally have those conversations and, in a sense, come out of hiding. And now I feel so privileged that the community is there and that I can be a part of it. And I also think of disability as a kind of magnifier to the human condition, in the sense that much of what we go through, which you had said, is similar to what other people go through, but maybe more acute or more noticeable. And that's certainly something that I came to understand when I was struggling as a mother, the way that I wrote about. Because I first began writing about disability when, by writing about that experience, and I had that same thought. Nobody's gonna care. Nobody's gonna relate, or very few people will. And in fact, I got a lot of response from non-disabled people who said, you know, yeah, it's really hard. Yeah. And you know, a friend of mine who had twins, you know, could completely relate to not having access to both our hands at the same time.
Without a doubt. I want to ask Anne and Daniel the same question, and then we've got some callers that we want to get to with questions for each of you. Anne, what's been the gift for you?
Well, I'm going to be ornery here. I don't see ichthyosis as a gift. I honestly don't. There are some people who are wonderful writers, and they're wonderful people, and they say, and this is in many ways very thrilling, we are fine the way we are. There is nothing wrong with us. The problem with disability is the way society looks at you, or the built environment if you have mobility issues. I wish I could believe that, but I'll tell you a quick story. When I was 35, I got some medicine which made an enormous difference to my skin. Previously, it had been extremely thick and really rather like the bark of a tree. And when I was 35 years old, I got some medicine, and literally within a week, the skin, the scales on my body left me. And when I got home from the hospital, I was living in a little apartment in Narberth across from the railroad station. I always thought everybody on the train could see me. And when I got home, I closed the curtains, I took a bath, and as naked as the day I was born, I sat on my floor and rubbed my hands all over my body, and it felt wonderful. Mm. It just felt so much more at ease, so much more softer than it had before. So I'm pro drugs. I'm pro being helped. And a community is enormously important, as Ona points out. And I was 50 before I knew other people with disabilities. But I fell in with writers, lucky me. And so that has, of course, been a great joy.
Yeah. Daniel, how about you? Has there been a gift?
Oh, yeah. I love going out into the world, coming into Center City and traveling around, because the gift is I was forced early on to be comfortable with asking for help. And I will say as a side comment that I saw it really how it paid great dividends. My twin brother died of ALS about almost 4 years ago. And he was so used to asking for help that he made friends with all his caregivers and lived life really well to the very, very end. But I love going shopping. There's stores in Lansdowne where we live where I just have friends who are my store friends. I go, they grocery shop with me. I say, let's check out the pastry, but which ones do you like?
First things first.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, one of the person shopping with me said, I've tried them all. They're all wonderful. I said, well, let's not tell Ona. So it's just fun.
Now you tell me on radio.
Right.
You see the things you learn.
It's fun. It's fun. And I've also had the chance then to walk with all sorts of people hand in hand, construction workers getting me through torn up pavement, somebody walking to their office who helps me figure the right exit out of Suburban Station, which is really a challenge. And so I love that some of these people I'll see, you know, once and never again, and other people we may cross paths and they become kind of they become sort of friends.
So once again, that sense of community becomes so important. We have a number of questions from our listeners. This one is from Carrie, and we only have a minute left, so we'll see what we can squeeze in here. Carrie says, I have twin daughters, and one has a genetic disorder while the other doesn't. Have your guests experienced any kind of resentment in their relationships with their siblings who do not have disabilities?
I'll take that because I have a twin brother who does not have a disability. And I'm one lucky woman because he is an absolutely lovely, loving person. And no, there's never been any resentment. I think there's a certain amount of guilt, which is totally understandable, but there's never been any resentment. We are, of course, brother and sister. But nevertheless, he's been a fabulous support to me. I've loved his family. His kids have been, my nephew and his niece have been wonderful in my life. So, yeah, you can do it. And we come from an Irish Catholic family where you don't talk about serious things. So whether that's good or bad, I don't know. And if that's listening.
Well, we'll pick that up right there. We have to take a quick break in, but we're going to come right back with calls from our listeners when Radio Times returns. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about disabilities today, and we are talking specifically about a brand new book called About Us: Essays from the Disability Series of the New York Times. And as the title implies, it is a compilation of 60 essays from people who are living with various types of disabilities, sharing their stories. And it's largely an effort to not only be able to share those stories, but to help people who are not disabled understand the many commonalities that we all have, but also to understand what life is like and how to navigate with a disability. We've been talking with three local writers who are all contributors to that book. Our guests are Ann Kyer, Ona Gritz, and Daniel Simpson, and they've been sharing with us some of their work as well as some of the stories from their lives and lessons learned. We've got lots of listeners who are standing by waiting to talk with our guests, so let me quickly give the contact information and we'll jump into the calls. You can call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We will start off with Lois, who is calling from Yardley. Lois, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Hi, Ona.
Hi, Lois.
A friend of yours.
Ona is a coworker and an old friend of mine. And I thought it would be good because Ona is one of the more independent people that I know. And I thought it would be good if she would address the needs for accommodation in the workplace, which she very seldom asked for. And we did not work in a particularly accommodating place. And I wondered if it was just her innate independence or the fact that it would have been really hard to get the accommodation.
Well, thank you, Lois, for your question. Ona, what do you say to that?
Well, Lois and I were librarians together. And I, you know, it's interesting because I have not needed a lot of accommodations. And I've learned a lot about accommodations by traveling with Dan. But So we worked in an old building, and the hardest thing for me was the staircase out front. It had a banister, but people loved to lean on the banister. So I always had to ask people to let me use it. And yeah. Some people seemed surprised, which was an interesting thing to encounter. But the one accommodation I needed was they changed, was it the punch clock system where they started using our handprints?
Yeah.
And I couldn't.
That was quite a ways in for you.
Yes, it was. It was years in where instead of just punching a clock in the old fashioned way, and I couldn't do it. But they figured out a way to just kind of let my sweep work. And eventually they built a library. An elevator in the library, which was great both for people with wheelchairs and people who had children in strollers. But before I worked there, I couldn't bring my son there until he could manage the stairs on his own.
Well, Lois raises an interesting question. Is there hesitancy about requesting accommodations that could create difficulties in the workplace, that could maybe hinder in some way, you know, your relationship with your boss and coworkers? Is there ever sort of a hesitancy to make those kinds of requests?
I've had so little experience with it myself because not needing a wheelchair and not needing to ask for much.
Yeah. We'll go next to media and Mary, who has been standing by to talk with you all. Mary, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, I have, I guess 25 years now, I've had chronic pain and I look fine. The problem I have run in with and I deal with in different ways is getting people to understand that after about 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours, no matter what I'm doing, no matter how much fun I'm having, I need to lie down and rest quietly for about 20 minutes, and then I'll be fine. And I've gotten strange looks. I mean, you guys know all about this. And it would be really swell, maybe as a Christmas present, if people would just pause for a moment when someone makes a seemingly odd request so that they can continue feeling well. Just pause and think, how would I feel if I had to say to somebody, I need to stop having fun so I can feel better? It's a tough spot to be in. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Mary, for your call. I think there is an additional layer of complication if the disability is not obvious.
Yes.
Could I just want to go back to Lois's call for a second. Mm-hmm. Among the blind community, there are actually two major consumer organizations of blind people, and they have philosophical differences. And I think one of them is about how much accommodation to ask for. Then there's also the question of how to get it, whether you do it by trying to make friends with the organization that needs to make the accommodations or whether you seek a legal approach to it. But I do think there are questions people are worried about, sometimes are worried about if they ask for things. Let's say they go to a job interview and they say, but I'm going to need these accommodations in order to do the job. Will that maybe in an unwritten, undocumented way work against them?
Yeah, and I can imagine a scenario where there is hesitation to even disclose that on the front end, thinking that it could damage your chances, it could hinder your application and that
exactly.
sort of thing.
Exactly. There's a whole issue about whether, but there's also, if you don't disclose it up front, then if you get the interview and walk in, then... Yeah.
Does that create another problem because you've withheld the information?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So that you have to be, I would think, judicious about how you go about that process. Let's go to Northeast Philly next. And Harry, welcome, Harry, to Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. I'm congenitally blind. Blindness runs down through 9 generations of my family. My comment is about the politics of disability. Not the two consumer organizations, but many of the candidates running for office, if they mention persons with disability, they mention it passively. We're supposed to be in an era of multicultural and various groups representing. a lot of times I don't always feel I'm represented because they don't bring out this our group.
Well, Harry, thank you for bringing that up. Let's have our guests talk about that, about not feeling adequately represented in the political sphere.
I think it's true. Go ahead, and you take it.
All you have to do is say the words Donald Trump, and now I'll probably get thrown off the air. But, you know, here is a man who is insecure and cruel, and who took it into his head to mock a reporter with a disability. That kind of attitude trickles down and is allowed. And there was a wonderful article in the Times in this series yesterday by a fellow called Jonathan Mooney. And one of the things that he said that was that recently bullying for children with disabilities kids with disabilities are three times more likely to be bullied. So there's a noxiousness about the political air as against disability. So what do you have to do? You have to vote. Number one, you got to vote and make your power known. I mean, if we're going to be one in four people in this country, then that's a hell of a lot of voting power. Yeah. So we have to keep raising our awareness about what's going on. And the Times series is a wonderful way of doing that.
So I was also reading that I think any day now a ruling is expected from a federal judge about the Affordable Care Act and whether, you know, some or all of it may be struck down. Right. And interestingly, the Trump administration has already decided that if, in fact, it wins this case, it will ask for a stay because it's not a good look right now leading into an election.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Curious about your thoughts about that case and where that may lead if the administration wins that case and some portion of the Affordable Care Act is struck down or perhaps all of it. What does that mean?
Go ahead,
Daniel.
I was just saying it's going back to something Ann said. It really is interesting that the concerns about getting elected didn't stop Donald Trump from belittling people with disabilities in the last campaign. So it is a very interesting turnabout.
Yeah. I have a question here from Sue, who says, wondering what the guests think about, is it the Fries test or Fries, F-R-I-E-S test for disabled characters in fiction created by essayist and poet Kenny Fries? Does that name ring a bell?
We know
yes?
Kenny. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Do you know about the test?
I don't know what the test is, actually.
Ah, okay.
I don't
know
what the test is either.
Well, that will be something to look into then.
Yes.
Yeah. Question from Sarah, who says, Daniel.
I will say one thing. I ran into, when I started writing, particularly when I started writing prose, I tried my hand at a couple short stories, and then I wrote a personal essay. And in that essay, I tried to describe the way light was working and what you could see out of a kitchen window at night. And I totally, or what you could see in the window at night. And I totally screwed it up. And I made a decision. So I don't know, I made a decision that as a blind writer, I was not going to try to pretend I knew something about vision. And so I only write in the other senses. So I don't know how that relates to the Fries test, but that's what I've decided about my own writing.
Yeah, writing from what you experience and know best, right? Question from Sarah, who says, I have a chronic pain condition. My husband and I decided not to have children because of it. Did your guests have similar struggles when deciding whether or not to have kids? Thoughts about that? Ona, was that... I think it sounds like for you, maybe not so much.
Well, cerebral palsy is not something that you can pass on. Because it's usually caused by something that happens during the birth process or shortly after. But I did have a reaction when my midwife asked me about various tests. Don't you want to test for this? Don't you want to test for that? And I'm a very nervous, worrisome kind of person by nature, but I was offended by the question, which my own reaction kind of surprised me, but I just thought, whoever this kid is, well, it'll be fine. I didn't need to ferret anything out.
I have a question for you about that, Anne, but I want to read this comment because I think it's interesting from Annette. She says, I'm 73 years old and have cerebral palsy. I'm married and have two daughters, and people used to say, are those your real kids? Mm-hmm. Eventually, we just started telling people we ordered them from the Sears catalog.
I love it. I remember one person who I knew for a while who assumed I was my son's caregiver.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, what you said, I think, raises a question, and Anne, I'd like you to take this one, about genetic testing and disabilities.
Good question. In my instance, my problem is a genetic problem. I'd have to have a husband or a partner who had the same problem in order to have a 1 in 4 chance of passing it on. I will say that the medicine that I've been taking, I was really told not to get pregnant. Do not get pregnant. The chances of having children with really severe birth defects were pretty huge. So although I have not been married, nevertheless, while I was seeing someone, I was very careful not to get pregnant. Nevertheless, the larger question to my mind is, number one, every single woman couple should have the right to make their own decisions about not having children or terminating a pregnancy when they find out that perhaps there's a potential birth defect, Down syndrome, for example. But as someone who has a physical difference that is obvious, life is enormously interesting and enormously worth living. God knows my Irish Catholic mother would never in a million years have terminated a pregnancy with me. But I think it's very important for the society as a whole to recognize that and not to say, you know, we got to have designer babies and anybody who doesn't fit the norms is out of here. So that's part of what Dan and Ona and I and everybody in this book are arguing. In addition to the difficulties that we've had, we're very much in love with being alive.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I did have an experience when I was married to my first wife. My in-laws were particularly interested in knowing whether my blindness was genetic, and I said, I don't think so, but I didn't bother with it that much. Blind is blind, as some of us say, so who cares how. But for their sake, I went to a prominent hospital and was seen by a nationally or internationally known specialist, and she said, you know, most people have a 2% chance of having children with major eye problems. You have a 4 or 5% chance. I don't think you should have children, which is very unethical.
Goodness. Wow. Yeah. Gee.
And then she asked him to donate his eyes.
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And I was too inexperienced to just have outrage right there at the moment.
Yeah. Well, the music signals that it is time to say goodbye, but very quickly, Ona, there is a reading November
3rd.
Where is it?
It's at the University of Pennsylvania campus at the LGBTQ Center.
What time?
2 to 4.
2 to 4. All right. That's where you'll have an opportunity to meet our guests for yourself. I want to thank our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, our engineer, Diana Martinez, Anne Kyer, Ona Gritz, Daniel Simpson. Thank you so much for being with us today on Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Muscawain. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.